Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien.
This year's celebrations of the end of World War II have been long in the planning in Russia and elsewhere. But the spread of COVID-19 has led to the most important Russian event being cancelled for the time being. Putin announced mid-April that Moscow's military parade was to be postponed, but obviously Victory Day itself cannot be postponed. And already last year, Putin declared all of 2020 to be a year of memory and glory. So some events will take place, and we are going to discuss the importance of Victory Day for Russia, its relevance abroad, and what young people make of the victory today. I'm joined by Dr. Nina Fries at a safe distance of 2 meters in our studio. Nina is a scholar of Slavic literature and culture, and she's a researcher here at SOIS. She has published on the topic of memory, and in particular on how the Gulag camps are mediated through contemporary literature. Her most important publication in that regard is her award-winning PhD, which I recommend everyone to read after the podcast. And she's also the recent co-author of a SOIS report entitled World War II for Young Russians. Welcome, Nina.
Glad to be here.
And joining us from the other side of the Atlantic, at a very safe distance of nearly 7,000 kilometers, is Dr. George Soroka. George is a lecturer on government at Harvard University, and he specializes in comparative politics of the former communist space, and has a research interest in particular on how contentious politics of history play out in foreign policymaking. He has a book manuscript that he's working on the relationship between Russia, Poland, Ukraine, and the EU that he studies through a set of historical events. And I am Felix Kravacek. I'm one of the researchers here at SOIS, particularly interested in youth. So to bring us all on one page, let me just briefly sketch the context and the situation that we are in. The decision to postpone the victory parade in Moscow is the result of several interesting developments that took place throughout April. Earlier in April, the Russian Duma approved a bill moving the date honoring the end of the Second World War in Russia from September 2nd to September 3rd. The date, so my impression, was largely unknown to most Russians and has in turn created some internal and international criticism. Because September the 3rd is the day of solidarity in the fight against terrorism since 2005 to commemorate the victims of a hostage at a school in Beslan. Putin signed this bill late April, despite criticism from the Human Rights Council relating to the disrespect of the Beslan victims. And also Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe informed Russian diplomats that he would not attend rescheduled Victory Day celebrations in Moscow if they are held on September 3rd. So the commemorations of the war have both an international and a domestic component, and we are going to first discuss the domestic implications. And for this, I would like to turn to you, Nina. Maybe to begin with, you can bring us into the, let's say, counterfactual world of what would have happened had 2020 been according to the Russian plans in terms of the victory celebrations. So what would we have seen across Russia on 9th of May?
Yes, I think it would have followed pretty much the same script as every year, but would have amplified what we have seen before. So at 10 a.m., the central military parade on a red square in Moscow would have started, including thousands of soldiers and all kinds of historic and modern military technology. At 10:15, President Putin would have given a speech to the people surrounded by aged veterans in their B-metal uniforms and other whip guests. After the speech, the parade would have continued for another 40 minutes or so. And of course, all this would have been screened. Those people all over the country and also abroad could watch it on TV. Additionally, there would have been local military parades in the bigger cities. And what have become more and more important, marches of the so-called Immortal Regiment, in which people carry flowers and photographs of their relatives who fought during the war. All this would have been accompanied by free concerts and performances, often open air, various activities for children, fireworks in the evening, and we can say all in all, it would have been also a big party The only thing this year that will be pretty much the same as planned is the program on TV that on this day is completely dedicated to Victory Day.
Okay, and what is so special about 2020? You said that it's going to be the same as the previous years, but just amplified. So why this amplification?
Yes, first of all, it's the 75th anniversary, and it's very likely that it will be the last time that a significant number of veterans can join the celebrations. And additionally, the anniversary takes place amid increasing divergence between countries' historical viewpoints. So just take the hot discussions between Poland and Russia, or Ukraine and Russia, for instance. And Russia uses these celebrations to underline its point of view, both at home and abroad.
And why celebrate a dictator and a war? Aren't there other bits and pieces in Russian history that one could focus on?
Yes, but the war itself was, of course, the most crucial historic event of the 20th century, not only for Russians, but for the entire Soviet or now post-Soviet population. No other country had such immense losses. I mean, we are talking about approximately 27 million dead Soviet citizens, which means that nearly every family lost at least one family member, which of course means a high emotional involvement until today. And nevertheless, the Soviet Union won this terrible war, which had made people incredibly proud. So this victory today is the most important resource for identification with the Russian state, for all of its citizens, a fact that the Russian government is well aware of. And additionally, it's of course a chance to demonstrate strength and unity, not only at home, but again also abroad.
Thank you very much, Nina. So it is the most important event to construct a collective identity for Russia today. And as Putin himself underlined, Victory Day cannot be postponed. So a couple of events are going to take place. One that Nina already mentioned is the Immortal Regiment, which of course can't take place as planned. But instead, what I've been seeing in social media and the press coverage is that people are kind of incentivized to stand on their balcony with the pictures of the people that they would have carried during the marches. People are probably going to stand on balconies and sing songs. There's also the intention to perform some concerts near homes of veterans in several regions, and young people are kind of encouraged to call veterans. So the event is not completely cancelled, and the 9th of May is going to be celebrated, but just in a very, very different form. But beyond Russia, the celebration of victory has also huge implications for neighboring countries and beyond. So some countries celebrate the end of the war as the beginning of a new freedom, the victory over fascism, whereas others bemoan it as the beginning of a new occupation. So I want to turn over to you, George, to tell us a little bit about the politics of memory and their foreign policy ramifications. And it seems to me that, kind of contrary to the situation in the 1990s, where there was a certain room for dialogue about recognizing one's involvement in the crimes of World War II, we have now entered a scenario where it's mainly about attributing blame to neighboring and other countries. So maybe we begin by looking at the post-Soviet space, George. What is your impression thus far, the intended victory celebrations, what have they done to relations between Russia and other post-Soviet countries?
Well, I think, first of all, that's a great point that you make. There was room for dialogue throughout the 1990s and even into the early aughts, the early 2000s. This has pretty much gone by the wayside now. Blame is the name of the game right now, and it's had very significant effects for Russian relations with the former Soviet republics. It's had very significant implications for Russia's relations with the former Warsaw Pact states, and also for Europe and the world at large. I would say two primary dynamics are playing out, and we saw this really begin, I think, in earnest in 2015 during the 70th anniversary. The two dynamics are that the celebration is becoming very much, as Nina said, in terms of legitimating the Putin regime and legitimating domestic politics, a Russo-centric narrative. What I mean by that is Russia is increasingly claiming this as a Russian national holiday. In fact, that's what Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, has classified it as. And very much forgotten in this are the other nations that took part in the Red Army and in the what some would call the liberation efforts of Europe made by the Soviet Union. So Ukrainian soldiers, Belarusian soldiers, soldiers from Central Asia, all this starts to fall by the wayside. So it's become, again, much more of a Russo-centric exercise. The second implication is that this event, being the central commemorative initiative of the Russian Federation, has really been used to mark its foreign policy and changes in its foreign policy. So it's gone from a parade that has, or even more broadly, an event that has celebrated or commemorated the victims of World War II and also the soldiers and the armed forces that fought to repel Nazi aggression, to very much becoming a military parade. And I want to remind our listeners that this was not something that initially, after the fall of the Soviet Union, that Russia wanted to do. Yeltsin was, in fact, very resistant to this idea of having this as a military parade. But Putin, particularly since his second term in office after 2004, has increasingly made this a show of a strong Russia, a Russia standing on her feet again. And this has had very interesting effects in terms of relations with other countries. So,
yeah, let me just intersect at this point, George. So is that relationship that it changes with other countries necessarily a conflictual one, or how is your reading of the post-Soviet space in that regard?
I don't think the relationship is necessarily conflictual. It depends on the countries you're looking at. So in 2015, for instance, Chinese President Xi visited Moscow right before the parade took place. He was on the viewing stand in Red Square for the May 9th festivities, commemorations. And Putin made a very interesting comment in a press conference. He said that because Russia and China had suffered the greatest numerical losses in World War II, this made them natural allies going forward. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, the war or the memory of the war has been in the present day repurposed to serve foreign policy considerations that are very much contemporary, very much situated in the present. You also saw this with the number of African leaders who were present in 2015. It was really striking. You had the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese army, marching on Red Square for the first time. You had African leaders there, and you had the vast majority of the allies not present because of the situation in Ukraine, that this commemoration was boycotted. So it hasn't been necessarily always conflictual, but it has realigned geopolitical alliances.
Right. And would you say that it has estranged Central and East European countries from Russia?
Well, I think that's a great question, Felix. Has it estranged East European countries? And it depends which East European countries we're talking about. Now, most of the former Soviet republics, with the exception of the Baltic states, still commemorate the victory on May 9th, which is the day that the Russian Federation commemorates it on. That was the traditional day it was commemorated on in the Soviet Union. The Warsaw Pact states and the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, have developed this narrative of the Soviet Union as being an aggressor. In some cases, there's even been a conflation of the crimes of Hitlerism with the crimes of Stalinism. So for those states, yes, it has very much become conflictual. And we see this with the Baltic states rolling back the commemoration to May 8th, now May 9th, as in all the EU member states, is celebrated as Europe Day, celebrating the signing of the Schuman Declaration in 1950. Poland was one of the last to roll this back. It made May 8th Victory Day, when previously Victory Day was celebrated on May 9th, only in 2015. But the effect has been very conflictual, because the Russian narrative has been one of ingratitude, and this has played out repeatedly. It's also been a narrative of historical revisionism. You saw this very much at play at the end of 2019, on December 24th, when Putin made this incendiary speech where he basically accused Poland of co-responsibility for starting World War II because of the signing of the 1938 Munich Agreement and the annexation of a part of Czechoslovakia as part of the larger Sudetenland annexation. And the narrative from the Kremlin has been one of many of the Warsaw Pact states and the Baltic states trying to whitewash their own crimes in World War II.
So if I may just jump in here, I think that's clearly a very explosive situation that we find ourselves in. If we look at kind of the former Warsaw Pact and the former Soviet countries and kind of the memory of the war playing out very differently in terms of foreign policy, there's also an additional component to that you've already pointed at, George, and that is that it not only concerns kind of the epicenter of the conflict itself, but even beyond that, the memory has led to kind of political implications, China, Japan. So the shift from September 2nd to September 3rd, It's obviously something that kind of brings up the Japanese fears of a more revisionist interpretation of the war, which then leads to kind of the disputed territories, the northern territories north of Japan that Russia gained after World War II. So it has kind of geopolitical implications, and we also saw in the run-up to the 9th of May celebrations how much it is impacting the political relationships between Western states. So French President Emmanuel Macron was quite quick to accept the invitation to Moscow, visibly without too much prior consultation with other Western European countries, which led to some confusion. And then regularly, the European Union itself find itself in conflict with Russia. Notably, the often discussed September 2019 resolution was one that kind of brought up Russians against the European Parliament because they saw the resolution which criticized countries for their transgression in the engagement with the past and singled out Russia as kind of an inappropriate attack and non-respect of Russian history. So international politics in hugely controversial in terms of how the memory of the Second World War is playing out. And in addition to international politics, coming back to you, Nina, the memory in international terms is not just done by politicians, but it's also hugely important how societies across the world, and it's Russian speakers primarily who are celebrating, who are commemorating the end of the war. Nina, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what has been planned by the Russian-speaking community and what is actually still going to take place under the conditions that we now are in.
Well, there are, of course, a lot of private or semi-private events planned by not only Russians, but let's say people that once immigrated from the Soviet Union or its descendant states. And during the last years, I would say from 2015, the biggest event of this kind were regional events of the already mentioned Immortal Regiment outside of Russia and even outside of the post-Soviet space. So, for example, we had those marches in Germany, in Norway, in the US and many other countries. The people who joined these events were mostly people of Russian or post-Soviet origin, but it's hard to say who is actually organizing these events. Well, when they started these marches in 2012 in Tomsk, and there were marches like this before, but they were smaller and they had a less catchy name, but when they started, they were organized by private people. But in 2015, the Kremlin, some would say, captured the event and started to support it. Still, they are broadly accepted in the population, but now it's really hard to say that these are events organized by ordinary people. So what is left this year, we will most likely see actions and events and social media dedicated to Victory Day. For example, the main organizer of the Immortal Regiment asked their followers to add the symbol of the movement, which is the crane, to their profile pictures in their social media accounts and to post pictures of their relatives who fought during the war with the hashtag Immortal Regiment at Home. And you already mentioned other actions that are planned in Russia and I think also abroad.
Okay. So let's move on then to another important aspect of this commemoration of World War II and other historical events. If we look at Russia and East Central Europe, one element that is striking there is the surge of what one calls memory loss. So kind of the pulling of historical interpretations into the judicial realm. Early 2020, the constitutional amendments in Russia also foresaw kind of a push in that direction. And the new constitution should have an insertion that reads that the Russian Federation honors the memory of defenders of the fatherland and protects historical truth. Diminishing the significance of the people's heroism in defending the fatherland is not permitted. And that reflects a development that George has already been discussing, and that is that Russia feels increasingly being under attack in terms of how it is seeing its own history, and that its own history is increasingly also at odds with how neighboring states, or some of the neighboring states, think about World War II. So the constitutional amendment complements a law that already is in place that is part of the criminal code, the law against rehabilitation of Nazism. So George, my question for you is, why do we see the emergence of the punishing of history as part of the constitution where we already have a memory law in place? What does that change in your opinion? Why that new addition to the constitution? Can you make sense of that?
Well, I think it's simply to reify a longstanding narrative that's been promulgated by the Putin regime, certainly even before Putin came back to power in 2012. Well, of course, some would say he never actually left power, but we already saw this beginning in his second term, meaning post-2004. Russia has a very reactive memory politics. Russia very much wants to protect its standing on the world stage. This is tied to Russian great power ambitions, which were never relinquished and certainly were again kindled by Putin, particularly later in his term in office. But Russia very much sees itself, I think, as being besieged by the memory politics of Europe, mm-hmm. which are very different than the Soviet memory of World War II. Jews did not figure prominently at all for ideological and other reasons, including an element of anti-Semitism in the Soviet historiography. But it also very much sees itself besieged by the new memory politics that's being conducted by its former allies, particularly in the Warsaw Pact. I just want to stress that these politics are very instrumental. Poland, for instance, claiming, or Polish leaders, I should say, claiming that the Soviet Union bears co-responsibility for the outbreak of World War II by the signing of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is exactly what triggered Putin to turn around and then blame Poland for the signing of the previous year's 1938 Munich Agreement. So this has gone beyond memory, right? And this is a particularly dangerous moment in time because, as Nina pointed out, 2020 is likely the last time we still have a significant number of people who remember fighting in World War II alive to take part in these commemorations. Once that link is lost, memory becomes even more available for various political usages, which Russia and also the Warsaw Pact states and also Europe has shown itself quite willing to engage in.
So if we look at, for instance, the joint statement that was made on the 27th of January, so the Holocaust Remembrance Day, by the presidents of the European Commission, the European Council and the European Parliament, one might have actually sympathy with this Russian approach, because that joint statement read that it were Allied forces that liberated the Nazi concentration camp of Auschwitz. I mean, when one reads these statements and considers what Nina has said about the atrocities of the war and the number of victims, how does that maybe help us in understanding what Russia is engaging in and why the Constitution now even includes this mission for the country to protect the historical truth? I mean, can you sympathize with that, or what is your interpretation of the situation in Russia?
Well, I think, of course, we can sympathize with that. I think not even someone who's in Russia, but any student of history can sympathize. The problem with introducing history into political legislation is that it invariably simplifies it. And simplified history is useless history. It's lacking nuance. The problem with the 2014 law and subsequent measures that have been taken is that it doesn't allow for a frank discussion of both sides' role in this conflict. And it was very nuanced and it was problematic. And leaving that aside, history then becomes simply a catchphrase. It becomes simply a political rallying point that doesn't demand much thinking. It becomes something that can be easily utilized for various instrumental purposes by whatever regime you have. And I don't mean at all to downplay what's been done in some of the former Warsaw Pact states. I think from a historical perspective, it's something that's not to be lauded. Much of the narrative there has essentially been, well, anybody who sided with Nazi Germany was a freedom fighter, and the imposition of communism was completely an exogenous event. There were no local communists, or if there were local communists, these were all fifth column. Right. Now, obviously, this distorts history. This does a lot of violence to history. But that's the problem with trying to codify how history should be remembered. History is a dynamic, living thing to be studied and to be researched. And it doesn't lend itself very well to inclusion in a law, to inclusion in a constitutional amendment.
Okay. Thanks, Dot. That's, I think, very important to make that point. And Nina, we've both been looking at some of the nuances when it comes to historical memory. So we've both published a report on how young people, so that's those born in the late 1980s and throughout the 1990s and by now the early 2000s as well, how they remember World War II. And young people in Russia have become an increasing center of attention. And the Kremlin is very spending significant resources to make sure that young people absorb the right historical views. Sonia, the report that we wrote combines social science data and the analysis of cultural artifacts. Well, why did we focus on youth? What did you find most interesting in this approach?
Well, I think we took a little bit the position of the Russian government and asked why did they target youth? To put it very simple, young people will be the future population. Those, as a government, you have to care about their views as early as possible. And it tells you a lot about the government, what they want to do with youth. So this is particularly interesting. And in the same way, historical views of young people seem to be still shapeable. And there are a lot of institutions where young people have to spend a lot of time and where the state may control the agenda. So the most obvious example for this are history classes at school, where we have observed significant changes in the history textbooks during the last years. But we also have other classes at school where historic views might be shaped as well. As a scholar for Russian literature and culture, I would like to mention Russian literature classes dedicated to World War II, which of course might also influence the way young people think about the war. So this may be 2 points.
And then, of course, one can find a lot of the nuances, I guess, in the cultural realm, because that's where maybe we can expect a little more freedom to still persist in Russia. Could you kind of sketch some of the nuances that you encountered for the analysis that you undertook?
Yes, I mean, there are, of course, a lot, but I will pick out maybe 3 points. First of all, I would like to mention the continuing importance of Soviet narratives, literature written by Soviet veterans, and maybe even more important films that are based on these texts are important source of knowledge about the war. And of course, they influence the way people think about the war. So you can find these films on YouTube all over the year, but they also dominate the television program around Victory Day. So when you take a look on what is shown on Russian TV channels on Victory Day itself, we will find a huge amount of Soviet films and serials like 70 Moments of Spring, The Don'ts Here Are Quiet, and The Officers, and so on, all screened in the 1970s. Those young people today watch the same films their parents once watched in their ages. That was one thing I was really amazed by. A second point I found particularly interesting was that these Soviet narratives are far more critical than one would expect. If we take a very early example for a war novel, what's called In the Trenches of Stalingrad, and written by Viktor Nekrasov in 1946, this novel is still part of the Russian literature program at school. We see that the author mentions the chronic supply shortages of the Red Army on every second page, and he also describes some soldiers' lack of discipline, and this does not correspond with today's image of the Red Army at all. And of course, however, these critical layers are often not recognized by the readers. And maybe a last point, I was surprised to see that in the last 2 years, maybe before, but in the last 2 years for sure, several war films have been screened that specifically target children over 6, which means very young children. Well, I wouldn't show my kids films like this. So just to name 2 examples, there was a film called Small Soldier in 2018 and another film called Little Sister in 2019. They were both co-funded by the Russian Ministry of Culture. And in both films, children are the main protagonist, which is why viewers, children, may easily adopt their perspectives on the war. And therefore, the protagonists may function as role models for a young and maybe not only young audience, which is obviously what the films aim at.
Yeah, that's a very interesting component that you point out. It's the shift to the very young, which also seems to be very different to what we knew from Soviet times, where there was patriotic youth education, but that was not targeting children who were 6 or 7 years old, and not to mention kindergarten children, right? Whereas now that is what we see. We've heard this famous song of Uncle Vova, We Are With You, where you see kindergarten children singing patriotic songs, and that is kind of giving this a new spin. So that's where the Soviet narrative maybe has been even kind of rendered more more extreme in some form. And then the persistence of Soviet narratives that you point out, a few elements that I found striking there is how that also persists in what young people make of the war. So the focus groups that I conducted reflect some of what you've sketched, and in particular, it's the idea of the unity of the people and kind of the nostalgic and romanticized view of how all of the Soviet Union was united in fighting this external enemy, and that has an important kind of ethnic component to it, but also a social component. So kind of people of all kind of incomes, but also people of all kind of cultural and national background are working together. Another thing that I found interesting is that in the cultural artifacts that you've been looking at, the violence is mentioned, because without the violence, there are then no heroes. Whereas when you speak with young people about how they remember the war, the violence is by and large absent. And it's the kind of the moment of the victory that sets the foundation for the memory and then the rebuilding of the state and so on. But the experience of the tragic violence before is not what first comes to their mind. And then maybe one last thing that I think we both found quite interesting is how controversial, nevertheless, today's celebrations are. Whereas one has the impression, looking at Russia from the outside, that it's the entire country marching down the roads for the Immortal Regiment. Actually, that's of course an exaggeration, but kind of you can get that impression reading some of the comments. Whereas within the country itself, it is fairly contested what ought to be done and whether today's forms of celebrating the victory are maybe too much of a facade, are detached from the people and detached from the historical moment itself. So I think that gives some of the nuances that are bound to be pushed to the margins when history becomes part of the penal code or the historical interpretation even part of the constitution. So I think we've covered quite a lot of ground in terms of what the victory means, how it would have been celebrated, and even if it's not celebrated the way it was intended, it is still a hugely important element in today's Russia and will stay so. But nevertheless, to finish off, we are facing the problem, we meaning the Kremlin, that in 2020 one still wants to commemorate and one still should celebrate somehow the 75th anniversary of the end of the war. The speculation at the moment is that there might be a parade in September once the situation of the coronavirus has been brought under control. But of course, that is open to speculation. And I'd like to have your views on what do you expect to happen for the fall and what will this do to the memory of the victory in the Great Patriotic War, George?
Well, I think, quite frankly, it's too early to predict. I mean, as we know, Russia is facing a fairly dire situation with the coronavirus right now, and the reports that are coming out are not inspiring confidence that this will be over anytime soon or that the current regime has been straightforward and upfront about reporting numbers. However, having said that, I think it's inevitable there will be some sort of celebration. I don't think, given how Putin has built this up and given how much this is being used to legitimate the current system in power, it would be difficult not to. I suspect the march will take place in some form. I suspect it will be much smaller than had been planned. That almost goes without saying. I don't expect the presence of many world leaders, but I think, you know, this may have some interesting externalities, because if you have the absence of foreign observers, foreign leaders coming to celebrate or commemorate with Russia, this feeds in even more into this narrative of the victory in World War II being a peculiarly Russian national holiday. And I think, if anything, that's the point that the regime is going to try to reinforce in whatever guise the commemoration does eventually end up taking place, whether it's on September 3rd or some later date.
That's interesting. And Nina, what do you think? Can the regime drum up the population's support for another victory celebration day in September?
Yes, I think so. I think there will be an attempt for sure to have at least the military parade, but most likely without audience and for sure without the old veterans. And whatever will take place, it will be accompanied by the same speeches, the same concerts, films, and social media actions we will witness in the forthcoming days. So 2020 will be indeed, as declared by Vladimir Putin, a year of memory and glory. So I think the Kremlin will try to just to prolong these memories this year to the entire 2020.
Right, so we're going to see a long season of remembering. Well, that's a very nice way to end today's podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks to both of you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.